Romans 7:14-25, Pauline Tension in the Christian Life, David S. Dockery, Grace Theological Journal, Volume 2.2, Fall 1981, pages 239-257. The interpretation of Romans 7:14-25 has been problematic historically. Does the passage reflect Paul's pre-conversion experience under the law? This was a major interpretation of the Church Fathers. Or does this passage describe Paul's tension in the Christian life? The latter position is defended here by an interpretation of the exegetical considerations and an examination of the theological implications. Introduction. Romans 7:14-25 has without exaggeration been described as, quote, the most discussed and fought over part, end quote, of the epistle. In this grand epistle, there are several perplexing problems for the interpreter. Without a doubt, Romans 5:12-21 and chapter 9:1, chapter 11:36 guarantee a difficult task for the interpreter. Yet, as Matt Gorman says, quote, my nomination for the most difficult passage is this letter to interpret is Romans 7:1-25, end quote. Nygren says, it presents us with one of the greatest problems in the New Testament. It was already recognized in the first century, and since that time it has never come to rest. The predominant question in the interpretation of these verses is one on which there have been deep-seated differences of judgment in the history of the Church. This essay will seek to answer the important exegetical questions and attempt to relate it to Paul's theology. Romans 7 is thus seen as one of the pivotal passages in Paul's theology. Since the passage is located at the heart of Paul's explanation of the outworking of one's salvation, the view which is adopted will have a tremendous impact upon one's theology of the Christian life. Quote, one side sees too much bondage to sin for a Christian, and the other sees too much desire for the good for a sinner, end quote. A proper understanding of the nature of indwelling sin will have a significant effect upon the first of these views, if indeed it can be demonstrated that this passage refers to the Christian experience. In this section and the previous verses, 7-13, Paul appears to be speaking autobiographically. The reader cannot help but notice the extensive use of the personal pronoun, quote, I, end quote. In verses 7-2, Paul uses I, me, and my no less than 46 times, as translated in the NASB. In the Greek text, the 8 emphatic uses of the personal pronoun I further enhance that aspect. The question which must be answered is whether this usage is rhetorical, typical, or autobiographical. In verses 14-25, Paul continues to speak in the first person singular, but he leaves the past tense and turns to the present tense. The meaning and significance of this change has great bearing upon one's interpretation. The problem that should be considered, quote, concerns the temporal reference of the passage and the identity of the subject, end quote. What sounded like past testimony in verses 7-13 seems to be present experience in verses 14-25. Present tenses regularly describe action or state of being, which is contemporary with the writer. The present tenses also signify a characterization of condition. The third problem is the meaning of the anthropological or psychological terms which are so frequently used, as well as the intensity of the language expressed in military terms. The definition of these terms will be most important for a proper understanding of the conflict described. The fourth major problem is the usage of, quote, law, end quote. The interpreter must seek to determine whether it is law as principle, the law of God, Torah, or another possible meaning. The context will aid greatly in the consideration of this question. Various viewpoints. Throughout the history of the Church, many interpretations have been offered for this much debated passage. It is not my purpose to explain each of these views, but only to summarize briefly those which are significant. The various interpretations, as it will be seen, cannot necessarily be grouped into certain theological or denominational camps. Does the passage describe his present struggle as a Christian, or his former experience as a man under law? Or does it possibly transcend the, quote, then, end quote, now, end quote, categories? View 1. It is much debated whether the experience recounted is that of Paul as an unregenerate or as a regenerate person. The former position has been the prevalent view of most interpreters. Interpreters who take this position point especially to verse 14, quote, I am made of flesh sold under the bondage of sin, end quote, and affirm that this could hardly be said of a Christian, especially in light of Paul's statement in Romans 6. The Greek fathers generally adopted this position, as have Oldhouse, Kertelig, Kurzinger, Dodd, Sande, Headlam, Moffat, and Wesley. Kurzinger says that to understand Romans 7 as referring to Paul's post-conversion experience is a misunderstanding of Paul's intent. The change of tense is explained by exponents of this view in terms of a close logical connection between the two sections. The latter section merely describes the result of the irrevocable history, narrated in the earlier section, but both the history and result are a part of the past. One of the difficulties involved in this view is verse 25b, if actual deliverance has arrived in the preceding verses, 14 through 25a. Thus, men like Michael attempt to transpose the verses, but there is absolutely no textual evidence for such a transposition. The suggestion involves supposing a drastic change in subject between verse 24, non-Christian, and verse 25a, Christian. Borncombe notes that there seems to be a growing consensus that this interpretation is the case of Paul, that of viewing his non-Christian experience through his present experience. Thus, this view holds that Paul is writing, in general, about man under the law, man before conversion, man seeking to live righteously by his own efforts. He makes his account vivid, therefore, by illustrating its verification through his own experience. The above interpretation primarily views this section as autobiographical, though this does not rule out the possibility of typical application. This perspective owes its revival in modern theology to Pietism and was the dominant interpretation of Romans 7 at the beginning of the century. It is thus seen in contrast to Romans 8, which describes the transition for Paul from law to grace. View 2. There are some interpreters who understand the emphasis of the passage to be the law. It says that it is, quote, the experience of any man who tries the experiment, whether he be regenerate or unregenerate. Thomas sees these verses as describing, quote, a man who is trying to be good and holy by his own efforts and is beaten back every time by the power of indwelling sin, end quote. Thus he concludes that the conflict represented is not between the two natures of the believer, but refers to the effect of the law on a heart that recognizes its spirituality. Similarly, C. L. Mitton states that the text is a description of the distressing experience of any morally earnest man, whether Christian or not, who attempts to live up to the commands of God, quote, on his own, end quote. Without that constant reliance upon the uninterrupted supply of the resources of God which is characteristic of the mature Christian, it is essentially applicable to a man, quote, under the law, end quote, even if he be nominally a Christian. It can also be true of the converted Christian who has slipped into a legalistic attitude to God and to righteousness. In this interpretation, quote, the present tenses describe not merely a past experience, but one which is potentially ever present, end quote. Lightfoot notes that this is the most important aspect of this interpretation is the understanding of autos ego. This view is regarded as autobiographical by some interpreters and non-autobiographical by others. View 3. There have been some commentators who have understood this passage to refer to the years immediately following Paul's conversion. It is thus a picture of someone who loves the law of God and longs to do it, but is forced by a stronger power than himself to do things which he detests. This is, quote, no abstract argument but the echo of the personal experience of an anguished soul, end quote. It is supposedly a description of Paul still living under the law before learning of the life according to the Spirit. While being primarily autobiographical, It can also be understood representatively of all young or immature believers. There are many who either expound this view or lean in its direction. It has become very prevalent in parts of evangelicalism, especially in, quote, victorious life, end quote, circles. The basis of such an interpretation is the conspicuous absence of the Holy Spirit and the prevalent usage of, quote, I, end quote. This is contrasted with the relative absence of, quote, I, end quote, in Romans 8, and the emphasis upon the Holy Spirit. Those advocating this position see the passage as a struggle between the two natures in the believer. In Romans 7, the old nature is viewed as the victor because he is chosen to be under the law and not under grace. Compare Romans 6:14 and Galatians 5:16-21. Thus, defeat is inevitable because there is no spiritual victory under the law. Romans 7, quote, describes the abject misery and failure of a Christian who attempts to please God under the Mosaic system, end quote. Concerning the inability of a Christian to live a successful spiritual life under the law, it can be said that the child of God in his inner nature desires to obey the Mosaic commandments, but his sin nature immediately thwarts his noble intentions. The fault lies not with the law, but with the Christian. It is important, then, to see that the conflict of the believer in Romans 7 takes place under the law. Likewise, Fung, with reference to the Christian's inability, comments that the implication of the present passage would seem to be that the Christian is not to live hyponomen, submitting to the law of God as a legal code and trying to keep it by his own efforts. For neither these nor God's law can enable him to overcome his indwelling sin, but that he is to walk katanuma, who imparts that power which the law cannot supply, and who alone can break the denomination of sin and flesh in the Christian's life and enable him to fulfill the righteous requirements of the law. These men agree that this is not spiritual victory, and add that one does not permanently remain in Romans 7, but moves upward into Romans 8, which is a higher level of the Christian life. Ram asks, quote, what mature Christian has not occasionally felt, I am in Romans 7 again, end quote. He then adds, quote, how well many of us know that we cannot get to Romans 8 without going through Romans 7. Thus, Romans 7 is viewed as the picture of a carnal believer, or one on a lower plane of spirituality. This view is both autobiographical and typical in that it can apply to all believers. View 4. Augustine at one time understood Paul to be speaking in the name of the unregenerate man, but later retracted his earlier view and maintained that Paul was speaking in his own name as a Christian. This perspective has been adopted to a large extent by the Western Church, by the Reformers, the Puritans, and some of the ablest scholars of recent times. The Reformers said that Romans 7, verses 14 through 25, is a picture of a righteous man who is still a sinner. Luther said, quote, homo simul iustus et peccator bezagen, end quote. Calvin also adopted this view, but had difficulties applying verse 14 to a Christian, so he regarded the transition as taking place at verse 15. Those who take this to be the condition which characterizes the Christian life point to verse 22. Quote, I joyfully agree with the law of man in the inner man, end quote. These commentators argue that an unconverted person could hardly speak in such a manner. Furthermore, great significance is placed upon the consistent use of the present tense throughout the passage. J. I. Packer maintains that, quote, the only natural way for Paul's readers to interpret the present tenses of verses 14 is as having a present reference, end quote. Since there is no recognized linguistic idiom which will account for the change of tense. This final option, probably the minority interpretation, is offered in this paper. The two primary reasons for this position are, one, that it seems to be the most normal interpretation of Romans 7 itself and of Romans 7 in its immediate context. And two, it presents a picture of Paul's larger understanding of what the experience of grace means to each believer in his present state. It is a picture of tension, that of life in the spirit and the flesh in the dual nature of Christian experience. Exegetical considerations. Chapter 7 might be characterized as the great contradiction. It has been said that, quote, Nowhere else in the letters, and nowhere else in ancient literature, Greek or Jewish, is there such a penetrating description of man's plight and contradiction as in Romans 7, verses 7 through 25. The first 6 verses of the chapter assert strongly the fact of the believer's death to the law. This is done by a somewhat imperfect analogy with the husband and wife. The following verses demonstrate the character of the law, i.e., it is, quote, holy, just, and good, end quote. This is done by expressing the character of the law and its relation to Paul in his transitional experience before his conversion, chapter 7, verses 7 through 13. This can be demonstrated primarily by the past tense verbs. The shift to the present tense in verses 14 through 25 is indicative that this section describes Paul's struggle with sin as a believer. Verses 24 and 25 form a conclusion to this difficult section. There are 3 cycles that can be seen in the apostle's discussion of the problem of indwelling sin. The first cycle contains verses 14 through 17. The second cycle, which is almost a repetition of the first, involves verses 18 through 20. The conclusion of the passage containing verses 21 through 25 composes the third cycle. The results arrived at in each cycle are the same. All reveal the unhappy condition of one who is a bond slave to indwelling sin. In verse 14, there is a significant change in the verb tenses. The present tenses thus inform the reader that the statements of verses 14 through 25 are characteristics of the apostle's life. And by application, this characterization still holds true for all believers. This is the first reason for interpreting this much disputed passage as applicable to the Christian. Some have suggested that these are historic presents, but, following Packer, this is to be rejected. Paul, inversely, wants it understood that he is not deprecating the law. In the first section of this chapter, he says that the law is spiritual. Harrison takes this to mean that it is, quote, emanating from God, verses 22-25, who is spirit, John 4:24, end quote. Paul then proceeds to contrast this with the character which is, quote, fleshened, sold under the bondage of sin, end quote. For those who recognize this section as referring to the Christian, this phrase presents the most difficult problem. The law is recognized as spiritual, which refers to its divine origin and character. Since it is spiritual, it is possessed of those qualities which are divine, quote, holy, just, and good, end quote. In verses 14, 16, and 22, the apostle is primarily referring to Mosaic law. The comprehension of ego, which occurs in verses 14, 17, 20, and 24, takes the interpreter a long way toward the interpretation of verses 14 through 25. The best solution is to apply the ego to the life of every Christian, and the dialectic simul istis et peccator. The quote, I, end quote, should be referred to the unregenerate state in verses 7 through 13, but to the regenerate in verses 14 through 25. The first person singular is used just as it has been throughout the chapter, but now for the first time with the present tense, some expositors want to insist that this idea belongs to a stage of the Christian life which can be left behind, a stage in which the Christian is living under the law or struggling in his own strength. But Cranfield says, we are convinced that it is possible to do justice to the text of Paul and also to the facts of Christian living, wherever they are to be observed, only if we resolutely hold chapters 7 and 8 together, in spite of the obvious tension between them, and see in them not 2 successive stages, but 2 different aspects, 2 contemporaneous realities of the Christian life, both of which continue so long as the Christian is in the flesh. The domination of sin describes Paul's condition. Because of the similar statement in 1 Kings 21:20 and 2 Kings 17:17, it has been said that this phrase, Romans 7:14b, is proof that the passage could not refer to the regenerate. In the Old Testament passages, the person is the active agent. In the Romans passage, he is subjected to a power that is alien to his own will. Thus, Paul is seen to deplore this power, which has domination over him. He recognizes it for what it truly is, sin. though on the surface of the phrase appears to prove that the passage cannot refer to a regenerate person, the situation is actually quite the opposite. Quote, "The more seriously a Christian strives to live from grace and submit to the discipline of the gospel, the more sensitive he becomes to the fact that even his very best acts and activities are disfigured by the egotism which is still powerful within him, and no less evil because it is often more subtly disguised than formerly." End quote. Yet this is no excuse for complacent Christian living, but even more of an exhortation to push forward in the Christian life. The dilemma involves that which is willed contrasted to that which is done. This man wills and fails to do, and does what he does not will. The willing and doing are irreconcilably opposed. Quote, "willing," end quote, is linked with kata ergazomai in verses 15, 18, and 20, prosein in verses 15 and 19, and poriem in verses 15, 16, 19, 20, and 21. It is here, verse 15, that Paul begins the series of contradictions which are taking place in his life. Quote, "For that which Paul is continually doing, he does not know," end quote. Paul, by eugenosko, probably does not mean, quote, "I do not know," end quote, but, quote, "I do not delight in," end quote, or even better, quote, "I do not understand," end quote. Paul knows what he is doing, but does not approve of it. This power of sin, to which he is enslaved, dominates him. Again, it should be observed that he recognizes sin for what it is, and is judging it as evil. This is an act which only a regenerate man can do, that is, to agree with God concerning sin. With Paul, the willing is present, but the doing is absent. Paul is willing to do good. Quote, "willing," end quote, denotes, quote, "definite purpose and readiness to do the divine will," end quote, and is opposed by his, quote, "doing," end quote. The verse ends with the phrase describing his hatred for his actions. He despises that which he is doing because it is opposed to the divine will of God. The problem is the indwelling sin, which not only existed and wrought in him, but had its abode in him, as it has in all those who are regenerated and will have so long as they are in the body. Paul's intention is not to escape from his responsibility for his actions, but rather, quote, "to show how completely he is under the thraldom of indwelling sin," end quote. Man's history is so obviously in opposition to God that he must acknowledge in effect, quote, "Adam is in me," end quote. Such is Paul's statement in verse 17, which is restated and amplified in verses 18 through 20. Murray identifies three prepositions for verses 17 and 18. 1. The flesh is wholly sinful. No good thing dwells in it. 2. The flesh is still associated with his person. The flesh is his flesh, and it is in him. 3. Sin is also associated with his person, for it is in his flesh that sin inheres. Sin is not external, but it is internal, because it is, quote, "in my flesh," end quote. Flesh, therefore, should not be understood as an external, peripheral factor. The meaning of, quote, "flesh," end quote, in Paul's thought is, quote, "the willing instrument of sin, and is subject to sin to such a degree that wherever flesh is, all forms of sin are likewise present, and no good thing can live in the flesh," end quote. It is clear that the word has an ethical sense and refers to man or man's human nature, considered from the standpoint of his weakness and creaturely state in contrast to God, and also is the seat of sin. The flesh has absolutely no good in it. This is because it is ruled by the sin principle, not because there is inherent evil in the flesh. Flesh can have a purely neutral sense. It is because of its association with, quote, "sin," end quote, in verses 17 and 25, that it has this ethical sense. Dunn comments on Paul's usage of flesh. As is generally recognized, sarx in Paul is not evil. Otherwise, he could not use it in a neutral sense, or speak of it being cleansed, 2 Corinthians 7:1. Flesh is not evil, it is simply weak and corruptible. It signifies man in his weakness and corruptibility, his belonging to the world. In particular, it is that dimension of the human personality through which sin attacks, which sin uses as its instrument, Romans 7:5, 18:25. This is to say, sarx harmartias does not signify guilty man, but man in his fallenness, man subject to temptation, to human appetites and desires, to death, the, quote, sinful flesh, end quote, is nothing other than, quote, sinful body, end quote. Romans 6:6, the, quote, body doomed to death, end quote, Romans 7:24. Paul indeed desires to achieve what is good, but actually he achieves the evil which he does not desire, namely death. He explains that there is a great contradiction between his principles and his conduct. The reason is that, in his flesh there, quote, dwells no good thing, end quote. In himself he was entirely depraved. He was definitely a renewed man, but in his flesh there was nothing good. The final verses bring about the conclusion to this difficult section. One of the features which makes the last five verses of chapter 7 especially problematic is the repeated use of the word, quote, law, end quote. Also, the emphasis of the conflict is amplified with the usage of the military terms. The concluding verses have been viewed by as many as the determining factors for the correct understanding of this passage. Verse 21 is used to introduce a conclusive statement, thus introducing the conclusion to the entire argument. The law is perceived by some as the Mosaic law, but it seems best to explain it as a rule or principle of action. The usage of the article with
namas
in these verses does not mean that it refers to the Mosaic law necessarily. The adjective or genitive construction associated with, quote, law, end quote, gives the correct identity. The law is to be interpreted to mean a principle in verses 21, 23, and 25. The genitival construction leaves no doubt that the, quote, law, end quote, in verse 22 refers to the Mosaic law. The, quote, other law, end quote, verse 23 is equated with the, quote, law of sin, end quote, verse 23, or the sin principle. This verse, along with the present tenses, is a most deciding factor in determining the identification of, quote, I, end quote, in this context, as Paul and his regenerate experience. Soon adam I is an emotional statement and means, quote, I rejoice in, end quote. Quote, I agree with God's law, end quote, is far too weak for the intent of the apostle. Delight in the law is celebrated in Psalm 119, takes place in the inward man or inmost self. Paul delights in the law in his, quote, inner man, end quote. It would seem reasonable to interpret the phrase, quote, inner man, end quote, in the same manner as the similar usage in 2 Corinthians 4:16. It is the, quote, inner man, end quote, which can delight in the law of God and also recognize the inner conflict which is being described. The delight is not peripheral, but belongs to that which is deepest in his spiritual being. Cranfield comments that the meaning of, quote, inner man, end quote, must be the same as that of hanus mu in verse 23 and hanus in verse 25, which must be understood in the light of the reference to the anakinosis in 12:2. The mind which recognizes and is bound to God's law is the mind which is being renewed by God's Spirit, and the inner man of which Paul speaks is the working of God's Spirit within the Christian. The previous observations explain the analytical role of the law of the mind in the law of sin. Quote, another law, end quote, is obviously a law different from the law of God in verse 22. The other law is waging war with the law of his mind. It also seems quite normal to understand, quote, law of mind, end quote, to be the same as the, quote, law of God, end quote. Bruce identifies the other law as the tyranny of indwelling sin, and thus is synonymous with the, quote, law of sin, end quote. It is quite natural to understand, quote, my mind, end quote, to mean, quote, that which my mind acknowledges, end quote, and to identify, quote, the law of my mind, end quote, with, quote, the law of God, end quote, verse 22. When understood in this manner, verse 22 and 23 depict two laws in opposition to each other. In contrast, the law of sin represents the power, the authority, the control exercised over believers. Thus the power of indwelling sin is warring and usurping the position of the Word of God. Such is the essence of Paul's conflict. There are two laws or governing principles at war in his life. His faculties and powers are in enemy-occupied territory. Sin has invaded them and was fighting to stamp out every attempt at resistance and succeeding again and again. Quote, the strength of the expression is analogous to, quote, sold under sin, end quote, in verse 14, and should be interpreted in the same way, end quote. He is thus led captive to the law of sin. This captivity is expressed in strong military language. The military figure of warfare is carried on and is expressed in the clauses, quote, bringing me into captivity, end quote, and, quote, waging war, end quote. Both terms are common in Pauline literature. The indwelling sin is warring against the apostle and taking him captive in what he calls, quote, my members, end quote. The meaning of this term should be viewed in the sense of the same usage in Romans 6:13 and verse 19. Murray suggests, if the thought is focused on our physical members as appeared necessary in the earlier instances, we are not to suppose that, quote, the law of sin, end quote, springs from or has its seat in the physical. It would merely indicate, as has been maintained already, that the apostle brings to the forefront the concrete and overt ways in which the law of sin expresses itself, and that our physical members cannot be divorced from the operation of the law of sin. Our captivity to the law of sin is evidenced by the fact that our physical members are the agents and instruments of the power which sin wields over us. But again we are reminded, as in 6:13, that however significant may be our physical members, the captivity resulting is not that merely of our members, but that of our persons. Quote, bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members, end quote. Paul begins the final remarks to this section with, quote, a wail of anguish and a cry for help, end quote. The phrase, quote, wretched man am I, end quote, is nominative of exclamation. The nominative is used without a verb when it is used to stress great distinctness. Many commentators have stated quite dogmatically that it cannot be a Christian who speaks here. Some would like to view this as Paul looking back on days as a young Jew or Pharisee. Longnecker describes this position. It has frequently been suggested that Paul had an unhappy adolescence, crushed under legalism and casuistry of his religion, and longing for something of love and inwardness. This supposition is based in large measure on an autobiographical interpretation of Romans 7, verses 7 through 25, wherein Paul is viewed as describing a time in his boyhood when he came to realize the awful demands of the law and was therefore plunged into a perpetual and fruitless struggle with an uneasy conscience. It has sometimes also been supported that this tension was the basis for his persecution of Christians, that he was attempting to externalize the conflict within by identifying what he detested in himself with some other body, and was trying to silence his doubts by activity. But such is not the case. This is an attempt to read some of the dramatic conversions like those of Augustine or Luther into Paul's experience. This is mere conjecture. Rather, it is better to view it as the height of one's spiritual condition. True, spirituality is recognizing and judging sin in one's own life. This is the case when one views sin in his life as an offense toward a holy God and not just loss of personal victory. As one matures and progresses in his spiritual pilgrimage and knowledge of God, such will be the case. Granted that the word, quote, wretched, end quote, indicates a state of distress, but it is not a state of hopelessness. Cranfield's comments on this are excellent. The truth is surely the inability to recognize the distress reflected in this cry as characteristic of Christian existence, argues a failure to grasp the full seriousness of the Christian's obligation to express his gratitude to God by obedience of life. The farther men advance in the Christian life and the more mature their discipleship, the clearer becomes their perception of the heights to which God calls them, and the more painfully sharp their consciousness of the distance between what they ought and want to be and what they are. The greatest difficulty in this verse concerns the meaning of, quote, "Who shall deliver me from the body of this death?" end quote. Even though, quote, "this," end quote, is taken with, quote, "body," end quote, in the NIV, NEB, and RSV, the emphasis seems to be on death, and thus, quote, "this," end quote, should be taken with, quote, "death," end quote, NASB. It is therefore properly used in a predicate construction. Quote, "body," end quote, in verse 24, refers to the material human organism, as in Romans 6:6. Quote, Paul uses soma for human life enslaved to sin. Romans 1:24, 6:6, 7:24, 8:10, 13. Compare Colossians 3:5. The body is not inherently sinful, but the sin principle is still operating in its members, the natural result of which is death. The emphasis of this passage seems to fall on, quote, "this death," end quote. It is, quote, "this death," end quote, which comes from the indwelling sin. Even though Paul is renewed and justified, death is still a reality. Hence, what Paul longs for is deliverance from sin in all its aspects and consequences. The body can be regarded as the body of this death. The bodily members are the sphere in which the law of sin is operative onto the death, which is the wages of sin. Barth concludes, quote, "Indissolubly and indistinguishably, one with his mortal body, he bears about with him always the reminder that he, yes, precisely he, must die," end quote. Verse 25 gives an indirect answer to the question of verse 24. The deliverance is to be taken as future in the resurrection, Romans 8:23, 1 Corinthians 15:57. Fung, however, opts for present deliverance, which is available from the sin which dominates him. He supposes a change of speaker between verses 24, which he views as the Christian, and verse 25, whom he understands to be Paul. This presents quite a difficulty in his exegesis. Thus, it is proper to apprehend deliverance as future. It is true because verse 25b would seem to sum up the present experience. This section concerns the struggle with indwelling sin, which characterizes the normal Christian condition. Those who advocate verse 25a as a present deliverance have no answer for Paul's summary statement in verse 25b. The indirect answer suggests that the speaker knows either that God has already fulfilled for him the wish expressed by the question, or that God will surely fulfill it for him in the future. He has not been delivered, but he knows that God will surely deliver him from it in the future. The key to the right understanding of verse 25a is the recognition that the man who speaks in verse 24 is already a Christian, for that saves us from the necessity of conjecturing a drastic change between verses 24 and 25a. The previous understanding prevents the embarrassment of having to ignore verse 25b or to view it as a textual gloss. Therefore, far from being an anticlimactic or incongruous intrusion, it is a summing up of the entire argument begun at verse 14. Autos ego is translating, quote, "I myself," end quote, and not, quote, "I by myself," end quote, or, quote, "left to myself," end quote, NEB margin. The latter translations view verse 25a as a present delivery from the indwelling sin, and then 25b as harking back to the prior state of 25a, when the believer who lives at a lower level of spirituality, or even the unbeliever, is again left to himself. This is a definite misunderstanding of Paul's summary phrase. The reiteration of verses 14 through 24 in verse 25b indicates that the triumphant thanksgiving in the early part of the verse does not itself bring to an end the conflict which has been described. The warfare continues, but Paul is upheld and strengthened because of the confident assurance that finally there will be complete deliverance. The text is gripped with tension. It paints for the readers a picture of the Christian life, with all its anguish and its simultaneous hopefulness. This is the struggle with which the Christian is involved throughout his life. Deliverance is promised. It is also eschatological hope. The interpretation is not to be taken as an excuse for a slothful Christian life or for a life of continual sinning. Such a view would be quite out of line with the rest of Holy Scripture. Yet, the present tenses indicate that this state is characteristic of the Christian throughout his life. The recognition of the law as good and spiritual, and the determined will to practice the good, are evidences that this passage speaks of a regenerate man. The continuance of indwelling sin is the reason that the struggle is one which remains for the believer in this present life. At the same time, it is the picture of a man constantly and honestly persevering for the good. Both the struggle of chapter 7 and the deliverance of chapter 8 are true and real in the believer's life. Although Paul speaks autobiographically of the tensions of life as he experienced them, it is apparent that he speaks by implication for all who have the struggle and need for God's guidance and blessing. Theological considerations. It has become widely accepted that Paul's soteriology is characterized by an, quote, already, not yet, end quote, tension. The eschatological tension present between the, quote, already, end quote, of Jesus' resurrection and the, quote, not yet, end quote, of his parousia. The believer is caught between fulfillment and consummation. The old age of flesh is still in existence, even though the new age of resurrection has already begun. No one has elaborated this aspect of Pauline theology more helpfully than Oscar Coleman. Quote, it is characteristic of all New Testament salvation history that between Christ's resurrection and his return, there is an interval, the essence of which is determined by this tension. End quote. This tension is very much present in the Christian experience of grace, particularly as it relates to the theology of Romans 7, verses 14 through 25. For Paul, the Christian experience is a continuing experience of death as well as of life. The present experience of the believer is characterized by weakness, suffering, and death. This is clearly seen in other passages, such as Romans 8:17, 2 Corinthians 12:9, 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 7, chapter 5, verse 5, and Philippians 3, verses 10 through 14. Romans 7 is man as flesh. Man is his frailty, mortality, corruptibility. Man is heading for death, which he cannot escape. Quote, the body is dead because of sin, end quote, 8:10. Because death entered the world through sin, as the consequence and outcome of sin, 5:12. Here becomes evident that, quote, death, end quote, for Paul, has a spectrum of meaning similar to that of sarx. That is, it includes both a physical connotation, death of the body, and a moral connotation. Man as sinner, dead to God, the believer as having the responsibility to kill the deeds of the body. 8:13. The death and dying which Paul welcomes is a complex experience of the frailty and corruption of the physical and the suffering of persecution, of the deadness of one dimension of the personality through sin and the mortification of selfishness. He welcomes it because this dying is for him a participation in Christ's sufferings, a growing conformity even to Christ's death, and so holds promise of a growing participation in Christ's resurrection power and ultimate resurrection like his. It is the recognition of the spectrum of meaning of both sarx and, quote, death, end quote, in Paul's thought that enables us to appreciate more fully the paradox of Christian experience for Paul. Our entire Christian life is to be lived in the light of the tension between what we already are in Christ and what we hope to be someday. Thus, the already not yet balance in Paul's soteriology must be maintained. This is quite different from the popular view advocated by men who view Romans 7 verses 14 through 25 as the experience of the Christian who is living at a level of the Christian life which cannot be left behind, who is still trying to live the Christian life either under the law or in his own strength. Conversion is only the beginning. The new has not swallowed up the old. While it is true that Paul says, quote, we died to sin, end quote, Romans 6:2, Galatians 2:19, Colossians 2:11, 20:3-3, death is not an event past and gone in the believer's experience. Rather, it is an emphasis of the, quote, already, end quote, aspect, just as the, quote, not yet, end quote, aspect is seen in Romans 8:10. 2 Corinthians 4:10 and Philippians 3:10. The balance in Paul's theology must be maintained. To overemphasize either aspect leads to perfectionism or Gnosticism. The struggle in which the Christian is involved is a long life one. Hokema comments, to be sure, we cannot attain sinless perfection in this life, but our continuing imperfection does not give us an excuse for irresponsible living, nor imply that we may just stop trying to do what is pleasing to God. We can, in fact, continue to live with the not yet only in light of the already. The Christian never reaches a state of perfection in this life, nor is he ever freed from life-death tension. The believer remains in the conflict of which he is ever aware and responsible. Even though he wills to do God's will and is constantly exerting himself onward, the only way of escape is death. Finally, this aspect of Paul's theology must be included in the church's proclamation. Quote, proclamation of a gospel which promises only pardon, peace, and power will result in converts who sooner or later become disillusioned or deceitful about their Christian experience. End quote. While this understanding is not an excuse for slothful living, the believer need not be depressed nor conclude that grace has lost the struggle. On the contrary, the struggle is an indication of life for the believer. The true, preserving believer will be constantly struggling with this indwelling sin and judging its manifestations as an offense toward a holy God. The tension of the struggle, the paradox of life and death, must be maintained to the end. Romans 7:24 is the lifelong cry of frustration. 7:25a is his thanksgiving of eschatological hope, and 7:25b is the expression of realism. Paul's conflict is not a picture representing only a minority of the regenerate community, but of the whole church struggling with the tension of sin and constantly in need of God's enablement and blessing.